Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're in the middle of another Donald Trump Twitter war, but this time it's between Donald Trump and his own party. This morning, Trump tweeted calling House Speaker Paul Ryan very weak and ineffective, a counterpunch after Ryan said yesterday that he wouldn't campaign with Trump before Election Day. Trump also tweeted today, "It's so nice to have the shackles taken off me. I can now fight for America the way I want to." And in another tweet, "Disloyal Republicans are far more difficult than crooked Hillary. I will teach them." NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro is here. Hi, Domenico.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So, shackles off, to which a colleague replied, "Wow, this was all shackles on?" What did you take it to mean?
Well, I think that he's gone full Breitbart, is what I think. I mean, I think that Steve Bannon, who is the campaign chairman or campaign CEO, has now supplanted Kellyanne Conway as the person who's really in Trump's ear. You know, Trump is the kind of person who is a little bit like, others have reported, like an ape in a corner. And when the ape is in the corner and being pushed, he's going to push back. He's going to fight back hard. He's not someone who really showed a lot of contrition at that debate, as you would expect. It's very in character for him. And he's, you know, he's at this point deciding he's going to hit back with whatever he's got.
And you mentioned Bannon, the campaign manager who comes from Breitbart, which hits hard. Well, Republican National Committee Chair Reince Priebus also said last night that the RNC is still fully behind Trump. This is after Paul Ryan had that phone call with Republican lawmakers across the country, you know, telling them to concentrate on state races. Now, some were reportedly furious in that phone call. They wanted Trump to be backed. But what is, you know, okay, this is messy, it's just Shakespearean, but what else does this mean that Ryan is saying to them, hey, you know, support the local candidates?
I think Donald Trump's base has been absolutely hardened by this. I think that you've got 35 to maybe 40% of the country that is, you know, strongly behind Donald Trump. But there are other Republicans who need to get elected in places that do not support Donald Trump as strongly. And it's not a majority of the country, obviously, that is 35 to 40%. Donald Trump can't get off the ballot at this point. It's very difficult to do. He's not going to resign. He's not going to step aside, he said. So this really does strike at the fabric of the Republican Party. If Donald Trump loses, and it looks like that's what's likely to happen at this point, let's remember, people have not voted yet. They still have to do that. Polls are not votes. If that were to happen, if Donald Trump were to lose, there could be a massive civil war within the Republican Party and having to figure out where it goes from here.
Well, Domenico, it feels like that civil war has already started. And I'm just wondering, with Ryan saying to lawmakers, hey, do what you want, is that also a signal that the party money won't go to Trump in those states? I mean, we remember he hasn't built up as much of an infrastructure as the Clintons have. Does this mean he doesn't get support in those states?
Well, let's remember, Ryan doesn't control the National Party's finances. Right. That's Reince Priebus. And Reince Priebus, you know, he and Ryan are close. And Priebus was reportedly furious with Trump after the video had leaked. But after the debate, he circled the wagons, and other Republicans did as well, enough of them to say, you know, moving on here and going to support Donald Trump. You know, the Republican Party National Committee has pushed back pretty hard against reporting saying that they are not going to support him. But the RNC has that leverage. The RNC is what is basically supplementing almost entirely the Trump get out the vote operation. I think what you'll see is they focus very strongly on those down ballot Senate races in particular to try to hold the Senate. I think at this point, Paul Ryan is worried about the House. I think that's much more unlikely that the House would flip. But you're going to see a lot of triage being done over the next several weeks.
Well, meanwhile, we should say Donald Trump is attacking his opponent as opposed to his party in a new ad. Let's listen to a little.
Hillary Clinton failed every single time as Secretary of State. Now she wants to be president. Hillary Clinton doesn't have the fortitude, strength, or stamina to lead in our world. She failed as Secretary of State. Don't let her fail us again.
So Hillary Clinton campaigning today in Florida with Al Gore, perhaps to remind people of his squeaker of a loss there, but also they're talking about fighting climate change.
Climate change, yeah.
But you know, are maybe Breitbart, Bannon, and Trump brilliant because we are not talking about Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, and climate change?
I don't know. I mean, I think that depends on what your definition of brilliant is. I think if you're talking about raising money and getting clicks and trying to deepen a level of support among a certain sect, sure. If you're talking about winning an election, no. You know, and I think that this ad is almost cartoonish. You know, it shows Hillary Clinton falling down the day that she had pneumonia, getting into a van. And at the same time, Trump undercutting his own argument, saying at the debate that the one thing that he likes about Hillary Clinton is that she's a fighter and that she's tough and that she doesn't quit. So it's sort of hard to square that with her not having the stamina, as this ad shows.
Yeah, not exactly taking the vapors as she continues to campaign. NPR's lead political editor, Domenico Montanaro, weighing in on all the news today, including a new Twitter war between Donald Trump and the GOP. Domenico, thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Well, the Veterans Administration hospital at the center of the scandal over wait times has not fixed the underlying problems. That's according to a report out this month from the Inspector General for the VA, which finds that 215 patients died with appointments still pending at the Phoenix VA Medical Center in 2015. And delayed care directly contributed to at least one of those deaths. In Philadelphia, some veterans see their care falling so short, they're creating projects to help fill in the gaps. Joe Hernandez of Here and Now contributor WHYY reports.
Every Sunday, before many of us have had our first cup of coffee, local veterans are already gathering at CrossFit Inspire in Malvern, Pennsylvania, about 30 miles west of Philadelphia. The reason? A grueling 25-minute workout free of charge for vets and their families.
Step on, step in, step on, step out. All right, guys, whatever.
Retired Marine Marty Kenny started the group The Weekly Fight in 2015 after a Marine he'd served with overseas committed suicide. He's hoping to create a safe space for vets struggling with combat PTSD and provide support from fellow service members.
When I bring these guys together, we get them here, and they get to sweat a little bit, they get a little pain, there's a little suffering, and there's a lot of jabbing back and forth about, you know, putting out max effort and everything else. It brings some of that community and that sense back to what they're missing. And I think that's the beauty of what we do.
The group also dedicates each workout to a vet who committed suicide. James O'Flaherty left the Marine Corps in 2015 after several combat deployments to Afghanistan. He says he's still affected by combat PTSD, but he's able to keep it under control, thanks in part to The Weekly Fight.
There are some little things that I'm working through, but the reason I say little is because I'm not going to let them be big, because what we've got going on is bigger.
Is this part of how you manage it?
Yeah, without a doubt. No question about it. No question about it.
The Weekly Fight is part of a growing trend of groups for vets and created by vets that aim to fill in the gaps where support is lacking from institutions like the Department of Veterans Affairs. Therapist Wyndon Rowe says the VA often relies too heavily on medication when many vets simply want that feeling of usefulness they had in the military.
And the question always is, well, how do we support veterans? Like, how do we do this? How do we help them? Is it we give them money? Well, not necessarily. You give them purpose and task, right? So something to do and something that has meaning.
Rose says struggling vets often isolate themselves. Others, though, start thriving again once they've found a community full of people who've lived through the same ordeal or a mission to dedicate themselves to.
But it doesn't happen with, here's your pill, take it, everything's going to be okay. It's not working. So it's really more about putting lots of tools in the toolbox and finding what you gravitate toward that really does help you feel better.
Another one of those projects is a video series started by Marine Corps Staff Sergeant Joe Diamond of Mullica Hill, New Jersey. When Diamond first returned from a tour in Iraq, he divorced his wife, started drinking, and briefly lived out of his truck until a friend took him in. He started opening up to his friend, and that led Diamond to start a video project he called The Stain of War, in which he interviews other vets with combat PTSD.
Basically just get guys and girls to tell their stories open up and shed light on what the realities of combat PTSD are.
You know, I know that coping with it is tough. Trust me, I've coped with it, and you know, there's millions of us out there that have coped with it. It's just
that's Brian Fisher of Upper Darby, Pennsylvania, one of Diamond's first interview subjects in the Stain of War series. Fisher, who participated in the 2003 U.S. invasion of Iraq, says talking to the camera helped him open up to friends and family.
It was actually very easy for me because it was like me and Joe just shooting the breeze and talking about what happened, and you know, wasn't like just somebody, no offense, just asking me, you know, questions. It was one Marine that had been there to another Marine.
And Fisher hopes more projects like The Stain of War and The Weekly Fight will make it easier for vets struggling back home and civilians who never left to understand each other.
We've come so far as a country in the past 20, 30 years as far as veterans dealing with PTSD that, you know, in the next 20 years, I can only imagine that it'll be, you know, there won't be that bridge. It'll be all connected.
For Here and Now, I'm Joe Hernandez.
This week, we're taking a look at the state of K-12 education in the U.S., from charter schools to education policy to teacher training. And as we start our series, we're going to hear now from a teacher. Johanna Hayes teaches history at John F. Kennedy High School in Waterbury, Connecticut, and she was named Teacher of the Year by the Council of Chief State School Officers. Johanna Hayes, congratulations and welcome. And what is it that you do that made you stand out as Teacher of the Year?
I've thought a lot about that because I've been asked that a lot. And I don't really believe it's so much what I do in my classroom, but really what happens between my school and the community. I really do a lot to engage the community, to involve families and local businesses and community organizations in the work that I do, to get my students out working and doing service projects in the communities where they live. And I think that really is the thing that separates me from other teachers. You know, there's so many people in my building who are tremendous educators, and I just approach it in a very different way. And I think that's what it is.
So give me an example of something that you do to bring your students into the community.
Well, I'm a part of a group called the Citywide Front Porch Cleanup, and we do two or three really large service projects throughout the year. We have painted all the benches in Hamilton Park. We have restored the bird sanctuary. At one point, we went into neighborhoods and painted front porches and planted flowers. My students do various charitable walks around the city. We just really get involved in any way that we can in the Waterbury community.
How did you learn what you know about being a teacher? How did you come up with that idea to take your students out into the community like that and have that be a significant part of their education?
Well, I'm from this area, so Waterbury is home to me. So I have a different level of investment. But I also grew up in what was considered not the best part of town. And I know that, you know, when you don't have a sense of pride of place, it really, you know, does something to your confidence and affects everything else that you do. So I really know that my students, some of them feel the same way when they travel for sporting events and go to other parts of the state. There's this impression of how Waterbury is and how the people from Waterbury are. And I just want them to find value in themselves and in the community they come from.
But did somebody teach you what you know about teaching in general, or did you just kind of pick it up as you did it?
Well, I think that comes from, you know, my own upbringing. I was very involved in my community. I relied on community centers staying open for after-school programs and, you know, just staying involved and connected. So I just always was around people who had those ideas, a lot of community organizers. I was involved in our community center. We had a drill team. We had an after-school program. We had summer programs. And that really was the way you spent most of your time. So I grew up depending on my whole community. So I just, it's a part of who I am. And I just think about everything in a sense that it's not just one person. It's a whole community coming together and doing their part.
And what do you do about that one person, that student who isn't into it who may even want to drop out of school. Have you had to deal with that, and how have you dealt with that?
All the time. And generally what I do is I find something that they are into. You know, I have students who are really interested in sports or music or different activities, and I kind of go to their events and show them that I'm interested in the things they're doing and propose that maybe they should try something different or just give it a chance. And generally, once they come out with us one time or hear other people talking about some of the projects that we do, then they're hooked and they want to continue to do it. But I make it a point to show that I care about the things that they care about as well.
What are some of the challenges that you face as a teacher, especially in a city like Waterbury, which is among the poorest cities in Connecticut?
I guess just making students and their families believe that education is important and that there is value in the work that they're doing. And I think that I do that just by really using my own life as an example and letting them know, you know, we're similarly situated in so many different ways. We grew up in the same neighborhoods and the same communities. And while this path may not be for everyone, college may not be for everyone, it's attainable. You know, if you work hard and you do the things that you have to do and rely on the people around you and, you know, utilize all your resources, these opportunities exist. And I think that's probably the hardest thing, is just making them believe it themselves. So generally when I meet my students, I believe in them more than they believe in themselves. And then over time, I have to convince them that, you know, they can do whatever they set their mind to.
We're speaking with Johanna Hayes, who is the Teacher of the Year and also a history teacher at John F. Kennedy High School in Waterbury, Connecticut. And Johanna Hayes, I want to ask you a few questions about some of the big issues that have come up in education, including pay, the pay of teachers. How important is pay to you?
I think it's very important. I mean, it's such a challenge because we talk about teachers and educators being treated as professionals and the fact that this is a profession. So it's very difficult to attract young people into teaching when they look at the level of investment, the amount of money they're going to have to pay in loans to get into teaching, and then the salaries that they'll have. The other side of that is many teachers do so many things that they never get paid for, that they never expect to get paid for. So when that question comes up, it's always a very fine line, because I know that if someone said to me, well, you're not going to get paid for doing this, if it's the right thing to do and if it's going to improve outcomes for kids, I'm going to do it whether I get paid or not. But as a professional and an educator, I feel like teachers deserve to be valued and respected in that way and paid for the work that they do.
What about the issue of testing that has come up? People, a lot of teachers worried that they are having to teach to state tests because that's the only way to do it under the regulations that exist today. Do you worry about that? And do you think there's too much testing, too little? Does it make sense to have the amount that there is?
That always comes up. And as an educator, I believe in testing. You know, it has to mean something. There has to be some level of proficiency that students meet when they attend school. However, I don't think that that's the only indicator of success. And even before the laws and the regulations started to change, I was committed to teaching the whole child. That's why I devote so much of my time to service learning and community projects, because I recognize that it's not all about testing. You know, I'm very excited about the new federal legislation because it includes some of those intangibles, the things that are not tested. It includes, you know, student engagement and community involvement and all those things that we hadn't really paid a lot of attention to in years past. So while I believe that testing is important and we need to know where students are and how to better change curriculums and provide services to meet them, I think it should never be used in a punitive way. It should be used to inform our decision-making, and it should not be overused and looked at as the only indicator of success.
You think teacher evaluation should be linked to student test scores?
No. Personally, I do not. I teach students at every level. You know, I have gifted students who are college bound and know that coming in, and I have struggling students who receive special education services. And I look at students where they are when they come to me and try to move them along. And some of those students, even without me, will meet proficiency and do exceptionally well. Other students, I do everything I can and we move them along, but they still don't meet proficiency. I recognize that as a teacher, we have no control over the students who come to us and all of those factors. You know, I have students who have college-educated parents at home who review the material with them, who offer support, and they come in and can take any test and do exceedingly and abundantly, you know, even without me. And then I have other students where the only thing they know about school is what I tell them and what I teach them. So it really is unfair to say that I am the only indicator of their learning and vice versa.
So if there's another teacher listening to this conversation right now, what would your one piece of advice be to them about how they can be more like the teacher of the year?
I think that we come into this profession thinking that so much of what we have to do depends on teaching students to master the content or, you know, remember a certain skill. And I think it's so much more than that. It's about the whole child and showing students that we care. And once they begin to see that and believe that, then academically they'll rise, you know, their confidence level will rise. So I think just not focusing all of your attention just on your content area, but just, you know, really taking the time to get to know your students, the whole child, the person, you know, and show them that you care about them and they too will care about their performance in your class.
That's Johanna Hayes, who is the Teacher of the Year for 2016. She's a history teacher at John F. Kennedy High School in Waterbury, Connecticut. Johanna, a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
And managers across the country are gearing up for an annual ritual, what a Washington Post business writer calls a rite of corporate kabuki, the dreaded year-end performance review. A study by one corporate research firm shows only 4% of HR managers think these reviews actually help measure performance at work. And now Harvard Business Review reports that as many as a third of companies in the U.S. are getting rid of them. Kurt Nickisch is senior editor at Harvard Business Review. He joins us now. And Kurt, remind us, how do we come to use these reviews? You know, they grade people. Are they good? Are they bad? Needs work comes up a lot. We understand it goes back to World War One.
Yeah, it does. At that time, the U.S. military was looking for ways to figure out who to dismiss, who poor performers in the military were. In World War II, that evolved because the military was trying to figure out who to be able to promote, not just to base people on past performance, but get a sense of their potential. And so they developed a rating system. And essentially, companies, as they got bigger, they needed this sort of, you know, organization-wide rating system. And so companies adopted these systems to really look at accountability and development of their employees.
But now, as you tell us, so many high-profile companies, Dell, Microsoft, GE, are getting rid of them. Why?
Yeah. Well, number one, people don't like them, right? You just talked about that.
Talk to a manager.
Managers don't like it. As organizations have become flatter, too, managers have more people who work for them. They have more people to rate. And so it just ends up being an immense sort of use of time. Mm-hmm. And the people who are getting them maybe once a year don't really like them. And organizations have basically realized that as the talent shortage is there and mm-hmm. as they're fighting now to get really good employees, they have to do this really well. And so annual reviews don't really work well when you're trying to develop people, when you're trying to rate how they work in teams.
Right, they're more punitive. You sort of wait till the end of the year to find out what you didn't do well, as opposed to what? What are some companies doing instead?
Yeah, so Adobe, for instance, is one of the first big companies to drop annual reviews and decided to look at real-time input. That's a company that has this agile methodology to how they try to develop products. People are collaborating on teams. And so they actually focus on real-time input. They don't use numbers in their systems. They want continuous feedback. And they want regular conversations with their peers and with managers to try to come up with performance ratings. GE, for instance, uses an app to help managers and teams keep track of these types of things.
It's more about improving performance in real time as opposed to waiting to this big moment when you tell somebody you've been screwing up for 6 months.
Right, because that's just too much time.
Well, but there are companies, and we just take a second on this, Facebook, for instance, defending them in the Harvard Business Review.
Yeah. So Facebook says, look, people don't like performance evaluations, but they definitely want performance ratings. They want to know how they're doing. They want to know what they should be doing better. They want to know what they can do to get paid more too, right? And so they have come up with a different system. They've actually come up with a formula and a different way of doing performance ratings. And they say that it still does take a lot of time. It does the things that people don't like about them, but it's a trade-off and it does help them move the organization forward.
Well, Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. I just know one manager and she has pasted your article all over the office.
Oh, that's great.
Because I hate these year-end reviews. Kurt, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
An NBC Wall Street Journal poll out this week shows Hillary Clinton with an 11-point lead nationally over Donald Trump. And in many battleground states, Clinton now has the lead as well. But in Ohio, it's still close. So let's check in Ohio with Joe Ingles, reporter with Ohio Public Radio. Hi, Joe.
Hello.
And Daryl Rowland is with us as well. He is public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. Hi, Daryl.
Great to be with you, Jeremy.
And, you know, one of the interesting things as we've looked at the polls in a lot of the swing states is that states like Pennsylvania, even Florida, North Carolina, they've shown a trend toward Hillary Clinton in recent weeks. But Ohio seems to be a bit more friendly to Donald Trump. Is that the case now, even after the debates and after the tape that came out last week? I'll start with you, Joe.
Well, we don't really know about what effect that tape is going to have on anything because we haven't seen polling yet. But yes, as in general, Ohioans are embracing Donald Trump a little differently. He's got that anti-establishment crowd that doesn't, you know, they're Republican, but they don't like the mainstream Republicans, more of the Tea Party, you might say. He's also attracting new voters and voters who haven't voted in a long time. They love his kind of, you know, give him heck attitude. There seems to be a lot of pent-up frustration in Ohio, and his show business feel, the way he talks to him and the things he says, that's attractive to a lot of Ohioans.
So, Daryl, what do you make then of the senator from Ohio, Republican Senator Rob Portman, deciding to back away from Trump over the weekend? He's in a reelection race, although he has been leading in the polls. But does that tell you something about where Ohio voters or Ohio Republicans are that the Republican senator decided to back away from Trump?
Oh, absolutely. Rob Portman is perhaps the epitome of the Republican establishment here in Ohio. He's just running for a re-election as a senator for his second term. He's been in Congress. He was with the Bush administration as trade representative and budget director. He was a little bit later to the game. We were measuring this by hours, of course, but he finally did come out and condemn Mr. Trump's statements. I should say on the polling, I think, Jeremy, we are seeing a swing to Secretary Clinton. We just have a couple of polls, and frankly, both are pre-debate and pre-tape. Monmouth University and CBS YouGov both have Mrs. Clinton ahead by 2 to 4 points. Hmm. I've talked to some folks who've done some internal polling. They're seeing that reflected. Again, this is before the crazy events over the weekend.
Well, one of the big issues that Donald Trump has been talking about and something that has resonated not just in Ohio, but also in Michigan, Wisconsin, even Pennsylvania, is the issue of trade deals and the issue of jobs. Let's listen to him a little bit here. This is him last week in Nevada.
Ford has announced it's moving all of its small car production to Mexico on top of the massive plant that they announced 3 years ago. That's going to cost $2 billion. That's now complete. And then you wonder why we're doing well in Michigan and Ohio. Because I've been saying this for 5 years. I haven't been saying this for the last 2 weeks, like Hillary, who doesn't know what's happening. I've been saying this for 5 years. And the people of Michigan know that. And the people of Ohio know that.
So, Joe, as he makes that message, is Hillary Clinton countering that in Ohio, or how is that resonating with Ohio voters?
Well, I'm sure that's resonating with some of his voters, some of the people who like him. Although we've heard, you know, Ford says that that's kind of taken out of context, that that's not really accurate. The company has actually come out and said that in the past. And his voters don't necessarily believe the fact-checking that's going on here. They think the more mainstream media tends to lie, in their opinion, and they don't like what we say.
But what about that issue, though, that he's getting at, which is things have been difficult for a certain class of voters in Ohio and around the states in the industrial Midwest, and that things aren't good for them.
And that is something that tends to be resonating with some areas of the state. If you look up in Youngstown, that's a heavily industrial area. They've lost jobs up there. This whole idea of losing out on trade appeals to voters in Youngstown. And this year, it looks like he is attracting voters there, voters that, incidentally, in previous elections, many of them have gone Democratic.
Daryl?
Yeah, I agree. There's no question this has an appeal to many disaffected voters. And this is part of the reason why you're seeing Ohio being a little bit different. We, you know, Ohio's been the leading bellwether in the country since 1900.
Right.
But we are, having said that, over those years, we've been a little more Republican than the nation. And this particular election, we have Ohio sort of gets hit on two fronts. It's, to use that old perfect storm cliche, Trump is appealing to older white voters. Ohio has disproportionate amounts of older white voters. And he's appealing on this trade issue, which is much more important in Ohio than, you know, almost any other state outside the Midwest. You know, that's why he's doing a little bit better. But I think you've also seen 538.com, Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball. They've moved Ohio into Hillary Clinton territory.
So why, if Hillary Clinton is doing well now in the state of Ohio, isn't Ted Strickland also doing as well against Rob Portman in the Senate race? Joe?
Well, I think about $50 million worth of advertising, much of that from it's a dark money. It's we don't know who gave that money. We don't know where it's coming from. But $50 million worth of advertising has been spent for Rob Portman in this race. And it's been talking down Strickland. I think it was around the end of June when this money came in. And that's when you started to see the shift from Strickland being in the lead to Portman being in the lead.
Last week, Hillary Clinton made her first visit to the state since Labor Day. She won the endorsement of the Cleveland Cavaliers star player LeBron James. Let's listen.
I could not be prouder to have LeBron joining our team as we head into the home stretch. Now, one thing I know, I'll just say it because I know it's for sure. I hope to be elected president, but I know here in Ohio, LeBron will always be the king.
Daryl, how much does that endorsement matter? We know that Ohioans love LeBron James. And also, is Hillary Clinton doing a good job of keeping together the so-called Obama coalition in the state?
Those are two great questions. You know, this year in a battleground state like Ohio, you know, every voter counts. So if LeBron's going to get you a handful, well, we'll certainly take that handful. Now, what you said about the building the Obama coalition, that is one of Hillary Clinton's big challenges in this election. We sent reporters into Cleveland, which has the largest concentration of African-American voters in Ohio. Our reporter found a noticeable lack of enthusiasm there. You referred to the Labor Day event. That was at Congresswoman Marsha Fudge's at a park in her district, predominantly black area. And it was decent turnout, but it was in terms of hundreds, certainly not thousands. So she has a challenge in those areas. Of course, the weekend events could alleviate that challenge quite a bit.
Joe, what are you going to be watching for in the weeks ahead as the campaign comes to a close in the state of Ohio? And do you expect that it's a state that Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are going to be spending a lot of time in between now and Election Day?
Well, I do believe that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are both going to be in Ohio a lot. It seems like every day this week, either one of them or a top surrogate will be somewhere in Ohio. Going to the next question, what I am going to be watching is I'm going to be watching for these urban cores to see whether Cleveland, Cincinnati, Columbus. I'm going to be looking to see if they're energized. I'm going to be looking at the suburban rings around those cities to see if the Republicans, who tend to be mainstream Republicans and have not, a lot of them have not embraced Trump, I'm going to be looking to see if they start embracing Trump or if they're starting to even run further away from him. I think that's going to tell us a lot. And of course, this polling that will come out after this tape, after this weekend, will certainly tell us more.
By the way, has John Kasich, the governor of Ohio, suffered at all for being so anti-Trump all along?
Not at all. Ohio voted for John Kasich. He won the primary here. A lot of people have praised John Kasich, including Democrats.
That's Joe Ingles, a reporter with Ohio Public Radio, and Daryl Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch, talking with us about Ohio politics, just a little less than a month until the election. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Really appreciate it.
A recent headline caught our eye. McDonald's is selling pumpkin chocolate French fries in Japan. Actually, that wasn't the headline. That fact was buried in a story about how this fall's pumpkin crop will be bountiful, overcoming last year's shortfall. Now, every year we do our annual pumpkin check-in. Remember the search for the canned stuff for pies last year? So let's go to Morton, Illinois, the so-called pumpkin capital of the world. John Ackerman owns Ackerman Family Farms in Morton. Hi, John.
How are you, Robin? Thanks for having me on today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And you know, we're watching here in New England crops like cranberries suffer because of the drought. You know, there's not enough water to flood the berries and float them up. But you say what about the drought for your pumpkins?
Well, this year we've had an abundant amount of rain. Matter of fact, even though we have a great pumpkin crop, we've had so much rain it's difficult to get them all out of the field.
Huh. Well, but I thought that last year you had so much rain that it drowned them.
Last year was kind of a timing problem. Last year is a year I'd not like to go through again. It rained all through June and part of May and into July. That really ruined our fruit set, and we had a terrible crop last year.
Yeah, and in fact, is that still affecting some people? You know, when you lose, when your farm floods like that, is it easy to come back?
Well, like any farming operation, no matter what crop you grow, if you have a tough year one year, it takes several years to kind of make up for it financially. But we have a good crop going this year and a lot of people coming out. We're pretty pleased this year.
So you're saying you have just enough rain. I mean, did you have drought?
This year we came through very nicely. We had a nice dry spring, which is good for our pumpkins. By the time the rain started to set in, the pumpkins were always set on the vine and we were good to go.
Okay.
Now it's just how fast we can get them out of the field.
Well, who knew? Illinois, which we love for so many reasons, we now know typically produces about 90% of the canned or processed pumpkins here in the United States. And Libby's is based there in Morton, which makes you the capital of pumpkin producing. How much, what are we talking about, poundage or tonnage?
Well, we're probably talking about maybe 5,000 or 6,000 acres of processing or canning pumpkins in this area. And your average yield might be 22, 24 ton per acre. Once you start doing the math, you're talking about an awful lot of pumpkins.
Yeah, and you grow both ornamental and those for canning. What happens on the ornamental side? Are people, you know, how are people feeling about pumpkins this year? Are they coming as, you know, visitors to pick them?
You know, I think I'm finding more and more that people like to just enjoy a farm experience, maybe get away from the political nature of things these days and just spend some family time on the farm. We're getting a lot of people coming out, and they're really enjoying the fact they can come out and get a beautiful fall pumpkin.
Yeah. Is there a difference between the ornamental? I mean, obviously looks are probably everything, but is there a difference between an ornamental and a pumpkin that's grown for canning for pies?
There is. Now, on our farm for ornamentals, we grow over 160 different kinds, and we get our seed from all over the world. So there's all different colors and shapes and sizes. But those canning or processing ones, they're kind of a tan-looking pumpkin. They're usually oval and maybe 11 or 12 pounds. Those are picked specifically for their flavor and texture, and they've done a really good job over the years of making sure they've got a good-tasting pumpkin to go into their cans for pies.
Yeah. Well, look, again, after last year when we heard that, you know, there were diseases because of the flooding, so some producers, you know, lost so much there, maybe 90% of their yields. We're happy to hear that there's a bumper crop of pumpkins this year. How far do you send them? Because we have pumpkin growers locally across the country.
Yeah, there are people who bring they'll have different spots for growing the processing pumpkins. So there are places in southern Illinois that grow them that are trucked back up here to Morton. In years past, they've gone as far as Michigan or even Texas. They like to spread out the acreage a bit just to make sure that they catch the right weather conditions.
Yeah. And this is big business. We understand last year was 754 million pounds, valued at $90 million. Now, again, that was the smallest crop since the Agriculture Department began tracking in 2000. So this year, I mean, there's a lot of money and a lot of pounds of pumpkin.
There is. And, you know, there's people have talked about our local plant when it's running, you know, through August into almost November. Sometimes they talk in terms of $1 million a day worth of pumpkins being processed there. And it affects our community, too, because we enjoy so much having our pumpkin festival and our kind of our little slice of Americana celebrating that pumpkin.
Yeah.
Well, I was sitting here musing about pumpkins, and it finally occurred to me that I've decided my pumpkins are a lot like political candidates. I kind of think when we're out in the field picking, we have to be really, really careful about getting the one that suits us, because you have that opportunity or that chance you might catch a rotten pumpkin. So one needs to be really, really careful when selecting a pumpkin or a candidate.
Words to live by.
Just some news from the field, just some thoughts we've had.
Thank you so much.
No, I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
You love people who muse from the fields. That's John Ackerman, owner of Ackerman Family Farms in Morton, Illinois, reminding us to exercise our rights to pick pumpkins and candidates. And remember, you can combine those rights in your pumpkin. Go to hearandnow.org for a picture of carved pumpkins with the image of Clinton and Trump. Jeremy, this was at the Jack-O-Lantern Spectacular at the Roger Williams Park Zoo in Providence, Rhode Island. Our colleague Ashley went. They have 5,000 jack-o'-lanterns throughout the park. Uncanny likeness to Trump, but I'm not sure about Clinton.
The Clinton one does look a bit off, but you'll have to check it out at hearandnow.org.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.